Good morning. It is 7 minutes past 10 o'clock. This is the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio with Donal Kavanagh with you for the next 2 hours. A very enjoyable Friday panel with our guests and a couple of comments that have come in following that discussion. Caller saying that stopping council homes being built. We actually did that one. I can put that one away, I think. Caller saying, and unfortunately, whatever very often happens is a question comes in and then the panel is gone before we get the chance. Caller asks saying, should the government increase the pay for people starting apprenticeships? That's, I'm sure, linked to the discussion on the issue of a universal basic income, and part of the universal basic income would suggest that anyone, be they on an apprenticeship or be they on work experience or an internship, would get a basic amount of money guaranteed by the state. That would be the way that would work. The discussion, you can listen back, of course, don't forget, to the panel. It'll be podcast on our website from about 1 o'clock this afternoon, and you can also listen back and watch the show. Indeed, you can watch the Zoom interactions on our Facebook page and on the Highland Radio Facebook page, and also you will see it on the Highland Radio Ireland YouTube channel as well. Now, one of the issues and questions that was raised was the issue of in-calf cows apparently being brought to the factories for slaughter. Now, Minister Hayden said he wasn't aware of that happening to any great extent. Caller says, it is happening because the factories are struggling to get beef at the moment. They're using it for mince and burgers. I honestly don't know why any farmers would be surprised. The Minister, Martin Hayden, over the course of our conversation, did say that the government had had successes in economic recovery and that the economic figures and the underlying figures now are far better than they were. But a caller says, you would think, according to the minister, that we live in a thriving economy. Caller says, our country is broke, the health service is in crisis, housing crises, agriculture being hammered, pricing out of control, no regulation in most sectors. Government always seems to be reacting rather than being proactive. Our youth are leaving the country in their thousands and not a word about it. One hospital in Perth has 300 Irish doctors working there. Some country, eh? So says a caller. Now, we've had a statement in from Liam Mulligan, who is an Enthu representative in Donegal, and it's with regards to the Bagot Street Hospital being used to accommodate refugees. And Liam says, the statement yesterday by the Department of Housing that it would take 9 months to evaluate the suitability of Bagot Street Hospital to accommodate refugees goes to the core of the problem of government in this country. Germany, often regarded as the most bureaucratic country in Europe, has built a complete LNG terminal in the same time because they recognised an emergency. The General Secretary of the Department must go because he or she is responsible for the operational decision not to be bothered about the housing accommodation emergency. The Minister, Dara O'Brien, must go because he is politically responsible for allowing that decision to be made. I would suggest the whole government should resign, but it's unlikely that any alternative government on offer would do any better. We need our government, permanent and political, to wake up and address the real emergencies facing the people of this country. And thanks indeed, Liam, for that statement. Now, and a caller asks, what is the view of people with regards to the way personal information was released about Nicola Bulley? Should that ever be allowed to happen, regardless of circumstances? Now, obviously, there is a very long and emotional discussion taking place about Nicola Bulley, who was missing in the UK. And I think it's fair to say that, shall we say, certain presumptions were being made in certain quarters. And in order perhaps to counteract those presumptions or give some context, police released certain personal information with regards to Ms. Bulley's health and state of mind and her habits. And a lot of people taking grave exception to that, saying these are private matters that should not be aired in public. Now, the problem, I suppose, is that what tends to happen is what does get aired in public is innuendo and presumption and accusation. And I think this maybe is an attempt to counteract that, that would appear to be the situation. It's a difficult one, and all one can say is your heart indeed does go out to the family and to her friends, and it must be a horrendous situation for members of a family and friends of that person to be sitting nightly reading on the papers and seeing on TV speculation about the person's life, personal, their relationships, their friendships, their habits, their mindset, and so on and so forth. I mean, it must be horrendous. This is the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio. Now, did you know that the GAA are in the process of picking their next president? The annual Congress takes place in Croke Park at the weekend, and one of the names in the hat for the position of National President of the GAA is that of Killybegs clubman Niall Erskine, and Niall joins us on the line. Niall, a very good morning to you.
Thank you very much.
Niall, you're putting your name forward for this position. At present, you're the World Games Chair and you're also Killybegs GAA Club Development Officer. You're very much in the running to take this national position.
Yeah, well, I suppose there's three candidates, and I suppose it started off as the underdog. It's probably narrowed a bit since. Really and truly, in a GAA election, you really don't, it doesn't do to speculate an outcome until such time as the ballot is counted. You know, people are very courteous, and you know, the truth is they're very reluctant to tell you if they're not voting for you, that kind of way. And that's not down to any discourtesy. It's more of an abundance of courtesy, I suppose.
I mean, there'll be delegates at this Congress from every county. Now, can I ask you, how many votes are there per county? Is it done on a proportional basis based on population? Is it done on a basis of the number of clubs? How actually will this vote be conducted tomorrow?
It's done on the basis of clubs. Every county within Ireland has a minimum of 5 and a maximum of 11. Yeah. So the likes of Cork with its 150, 160 clubs would have 11, and you know, maybe like Leitrim will have 5. So it is capped, but it's kind of proportional on the way up to the cap. But every 10 clubs, you get an extra vote.
And who then decides how? We'll say, for the sake of argument, Cork is going to have 11 votes. That's 11 votes, which will represent 120 odd clubs. I mean, will the clubs be canvassed? Will each club have its own little election, and then those names go forward, and then the votes be allocated accordingly, or are decisions made at a regional level, or does it change from country to country?
By and large, it'd be the county management committee, and sometimes the county committee will decide how the delegates would vote. But usually, say this time, there's nobody from Munster and there's no candidate from Connacht. So by and large, I would say it's fair to say those counties within those provinces probably won't mandate, and they'll leave it to their delegates to decide who they wish to vote for. There'll be a couple of exceptions to that. I would say Kerry usually vote all the one way, and they'll decide within their management structure how that'll go. Cork would be somewhat the same, but the other counties, by and large, will just leave it up to their delegates on the day to decide who they think would be best to lead.
So do you travel the country then speaking to, number one, do you know who the delegates are going to be ahead of Congress, and do you get to travel the country and speak to delegates yourself? Do you get to make presentations in each county, or will it very much depend on, I presume you get the chance to make a speech to Congress before the election takes place and make your pitch there, or have you got a lot of groundwork done already? Presumably you have.
It's up to each individual candidate, but I mean, I'll speak for myself and say I have done a lot of travelling, particularly in the last 2 or 3 weeks. You know, and I couldn't have done it without the help of my own club club people and friends and stuff like that, and the support I've received has been, you know what, it's been very humbling, to be honest. So I have been around the country to, I guess I'd say probably 24, 25 of the counties. You go in and you just, you know, in one county there was 15 people there to question me, and some other counties would be 2 or 3. But yeah, you make your pitch that way. No, there'll be no opportunity to speak this evening. No, it'll be very simple. At the beginning of the Congress, the ballot papers will be handed out. They'll be put into a box and they'll go away and count them. And they'll give the initial result. And if there's a need for a second count, then they'll do a second count, on the transfers of those candidates being eliminated. It's possible, I suppose, somebody could win in the first count.
Yeah. So we could have an announcement tonight then?
There will be an announcement tonight. The president will be elected tonight.
Oh, very good.
If I had to guess, I'd say it'll be about 8:30, 9 o'clock, somewhere around about that.
Well, we'll be keeping a close eye on that one, obviously. What made you want to go for this, Niall? Because it seems to me that president of the GAA is almost going to be a full-time position. Effectively, what you are saying is that you are prepared to put however long the term is, and I can't recall how long the term is, but is it around about 3 or 4 years?
Yeah, well, it's 3 years as president, but you also do a year as president-elect. So,
yeah,
in effect, it is 4 years, yeah.
Yeah, so you're effectively saying, I am going to put the rest of my life on hold for 4 years, and I'm prepared to put myself out to do this. I mean, it's going to be an onerous task if you are successful.
Well, I suppose, yeah. But in those terms, it is. But I suppose, I just, to be honest, I feel privileged to be in the position to actually run for it. Now, the election will determine whether the association thinks I'm the best person or not. But if they do, I mean, if they do arrive at that conclusion, I mean, that's a tremendous honour.
Yeah.
Not just for me. I mean, I'm not really into honours or any of that sort of stuff. But it'd be a fierce honour for my club and for the town, and indeed I must mention my other club, Tyrconnell Gaels. You know, I've been privileged to be a member of two great clubs, the Killebega and Tyrconnell Gaels, and you know, Donegal County Committee and London County Committee. Mm. So I just see it as a kind of an honour. It's an extension. I mean, if elected, I would hope to do a good job, but my interest is the GAA. Yeah. It's always been that. But I know, for them, no different to nearly all the club officers I know. You know, we all go over time. And
but I mean, this is obviously informed by a deep-rooted love of the GAA, because I mean, you know, I'm fairly sure whatever expenses or remuneration is involved in this, I mean, it's not going to be enough to compensate the work you're going to put in if you're successful here. I mean, you know, you're going to be the GAA president 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Yeah, but I, like most people, you know, as a club officer, and I suppose now I'm chair of World GA, you know, you don't get remunerated. And to be honest, you wouldn't really be in the GA.
No,
if that was your
absolutely not.
I think.
But
I
mean, so there is a love of the organisation and a love of the games.
Yeah, of course. And I mean, it just grows. I mean, the more you learn about the GAA, even over the last couple of weeks, I mean, I really thought that I knew most of it. But when you meet people from other counties, from, let's say, the heart of Munster, maybe they're more hurling-orientated, you realise there's a whole aspect that you didn't actually know much about. Then you meet, you know, some of the smaller counties and the struggles that they go through. Mm-hmm. So one thing I never do is feel sorry for myself, because I've been extremely, extremely lucky in the involvement, and, you know, very lucky to be involved in World GAA, very lucky with the two clubs I've been involved with, very lucky in the positions I managed to get in both in Donegal and London. So, you know, I certainly wouldn't feel sorry for myself, and I don't feel put upon at all, and I don't feel, you know, I'll do it if it comes my way, but I'll be honoured to do it.
Donegal as a GAA county is an interesting one, because you'll have experienced over your career in the GAA, you'll have experienced highs and lows, you'll have experienced All-Ireland final victories, you'll have experienced All-Ireland final losses as a county man, but also at club level, I mean, you know, there are some very, very heavy and difficult club battles in this county, and Killybegs is at the centre of quite a few of them over the years. So you've experienced the highs, you've experienced the lows. In terms of the county's been at the top, and the county's also been one of the underdogs close to the bottom as well in people's eyes. So it's an interesting one. Donegal is not necessarily a GAA superpower, but neither is it, you know, a county that's ever going to be completely disregarded. It seems to me it's an interesting county to be from in that respect.
Well, you're quite right. I mean, I suppose in the early 80s, you know, early 80s was probably about 16, 17, you know, when Donegal were in Division 3 North. And just to put that in perspective, I don't think there was a Division 4. So we're very much near the bottom. I suppose it changed with the All-Ireland Under-21 victory in 82. You know, people like Anthony Malloy and those fellas brought that home. And then in 83, the Ulster success. And then, of course, you had another Under-21 team in 87. And it was the combination of those two teams that brought Donegal to the All-Ireland 92. So, yeah, I seen Donegal at the bottom. I seen Donegal at the top. I was Secretary of London. I mean, I was Secretary of London, I think, for 3 years.
Yeah.
And we never got a National League point in Division Four in those 3 years. So I've seen life at the very bottom as well in terms of sport and success or achievement or results. But you know what? The work remained the same. It was it was actually far harder than it was being a member of the Donegal executive, because there was that success and there was that recognition and there was all that. But, I mean, anybody joins the GAA just for the attainment of success. And I think, you know, by and large, the odds are that you'll be disappointed.
But I'm sure your experience in London also gave you a very close insight into the other element of GAA, which is an expression of Irish identity. And in London, I suppose, a lot of people are going to join GAA because it's a reminder of home, it's an expression of their Irishness, and maybe GAA membership in London has got a deeper meaning that it doesn't necessarily have in a parish like Killybegs, where it's taken for granted. Somewhere like London, it's not going to be taken for granted, and that's going to maybe give another perspective on it.
Yeah, you're quite right in that, and certainly, I would say that motivated a lot of people, you know, but the GAA is a kind of a family, you know, and outside of Ireland, certainly it has its own community. But I mean, it's even wider than that. I mean, I was at the Middle East Convention out in Abu Dhabi there, when was it, last March? And a girl came up to me after the meeting, we were just having a cup of tea after the meeting, and I'm not going to say the girl's name, but she was from Donegal, and she was the new chairperson of the GAA club in Oman. And she told me that, you know, that her family weren't really involved in the GAA, and yet she said, and it struck me very much, she said, but if you're not within the GAA out here, you really don't have, you're kind of cut off. And it's not that anybody cuts you off, but The real way to join a community is to join the local GAA club. And as I say, she told me her family weren't really ever involved in the GAA, and here she was, a young girl, and she was chairperson of that club. So that's what the GAA does.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a good point to end on, Niall. It's been a pleasure. We wish you all the best in the vote tonight. We'll be keeping a very close eye on what's coming out of Croke Park. We reckon perhaps 8:30, 9:00, we may have a result, but we'll certainly be keeping an eye on the social media and on the news. In the meantime, we wish you all the best, Niall Erskine. Potentially, possibly, the next president of the GAA and the first ever from Donegal to hold that honour. Niall, thank you and good luck.
Yes, and thank you.
I'm going to go to Councillor Gerry McMonagle, who's on the line. Gerry, good morning.
Good morning, Donal.
Donegal County Council's Housing SPC had a meeting yesterday, and one of the things that was discussed was a strategy to tackle homelessness in the county. Some of the figures that came up at that meeting, Gerry, very stark figures indeed.
Yeah, they were very stark, Donal, and there was the report first on the Northwest Homeless Action Plan from 2016 to 2022. And what it was shown was that the number of adults in emergency accommodation has increased by 93%. And the increase was even more in Sligo. It was up by 138% during that period. So very worrying figures indeed. And the sort of human side of that there is people without homes, families without homes, and insufficient accommodation, whether social housing or private rented accommodation, to meet the current demand. So it's something that we as councillors have been seeing for a number of years now and been raising with council, because we see through the representations that we're making on behalf of people, the amount of people that present themselves with us and at our local offices as homeless has been increasing. And due to the lack of building of private rented affordable homes and social housing over this last decade or so, it has exasperated and increased the situation.
One of the interesting things I thought in the report was that it seemed to suggest, if I read it right, that if you take crowd surfing, i.e. people who are literally sleeping on couches in friends' homes, if you take the figures for crowd surfing who aren't necessarily always listed as being homeless because they are deemed to have somewhere to live, but if you take those people who are literally sleeping on somebody's couch and add those to the figures, it grows the figures substantially, and that's an area of concern that perhaps hasn't been receiving the attention it deserves.
Yeah, it's recognised in the report that it's something that we have to get more data on. It's acknowledged that there is amount of support. Our people who are finding themselves homeless, both individuals and families, are relying on friends and families to provide them with accommodation. They're sleeping in sofas, as you say, and families in one small room, etc. And we haven't really got all the data on that, but anecdotally, again, we know that it's a substantial number of people, and it's something we have to factor in going forward. And I welcome the fact that the new action plan from 23 to 28 is going to take on that job of work and scope that and find out as best we can the amount of people who are availing of housing support through family and friends, and as commonly known as sofa surfing. So that is one of the priorities going forward in the new action plan. But as I said yesterday during the SPC, I think the action plan that's being put forward will go a long way to address and assist those who find themselves homeless at this moment, and others who undoubtedly will become homeless in the near future. But unless it's resourced, Donal, unless the investment's put in to building homes, and particularly we have no family hubs here in the Northwest whatsoever, where families can be accommodated as a family within a purpose-built development. And that's something I brought forward to council last year, and I'm going to continue to raise with council, because we haven't got enough emergency accommodation beds for those who are homeless, and particularly families. And there's an increasing number, as the reports showed, of families that present themselves as homeless now for various reasons.
Obviously, too, an additional factor in Donegal that can't be taken out of this discussion is the fact that over the next, and it's going to be minimum 5-6 years at least, and probably longer, we're going to have a large number of houses every year being demolished and rebuilt as a result of defective blocks, and that raises a number of issues. Number one, it raises the issue of labour, because, I mean, labour contractors and so on, for every labourer and contractor who is working on a defective block remediation, demolition or rebuild programme, that's one less to be working on the construction of a social home. And also the fact that if you are to bring in extra labourers, extra contractors and extra people into the county from elsewhere in order to expedite the building of houses, it raises the question, where are they going to live?
Yeah, look, it's a real concern. And as you said, particularly here in Donegal, where we're really badly affected by the defective concrete block situation. And it's at a crisis now. You know, with Christmas time here, we had to get emergency monies released for a small number of families who had to be housed immediately. Now that the regulations have been published and the scheme will be opening, I would imagine very shortly, there will be another demand for further housing to be made available. And that's why we in Donegal County Council, again, it's three motions that are brought in just prior to Christmas, and again at the last plenary meeting, that the government must step up to the plate on this, and they must put in place modular homes to meet those immediate demands from the MICA families, to help and assist them, alongside developing affordable and more social houses. But it's like you said, where are we going to get the personnel and the craftsmen and the builders to do that? And at the moment in Donegal, we haven't got them. So it's a massive challenge in front of us. But there is an action plan here, and we need to start following it. But it, as I said, it needs that investment, and it needs it now, not in this next year or the following year. And there's different aspects of that there, and modular homes is one of them. And we need to begin the development and the siting of modular homes now to assist with the MICA crisis.
Does Dara O'Brien, the Minister, need to sit in on a meeting of the Housing SPC and liaise directly and talk directly to yourselves who are members of that committee in order to get to the bottom of this? Because it seems to me there's an awful lot of talk about we'll contact the Minister, we'll write to the Minister, then the Minister will write back to us. I mean, it seems that what we need at the very, very least is for Dara O'Brien to be either via Zoom or physically at a meeting. So you're not writing to each other, you're talking to each other.
That needs to happen immediately. Look, there's been a number of meetings with the Minister, both the MICA Action Committees and indeed our senior management team. And I believe some of the Fianna Fáil councillors met with them recently. Dara O'Brien knows right well what the problems are here in Donegal. And what Dara O'Brien needs to do is the right thing. And he needs to put the investment into Donegal now to assist and help the MICA families initially with this modular homes to get them over this current blockage that they're involved in. But he needs to invest more in social and affordable housing in Donegal, and he needs to give the Donegal County Council the monies to put in place emergency accommodation and to increase the emergency accommodation beds to meet the rise in homelessness in this county. He is fully aware of it. He has the statistics. I'm sure his department would have received the same homelessness action report that we received yesterday. But what for us and Donegal County Council, we're dependent on his input and their investment and resourcing of the housing that's going to meet this demand. And that's all he has to do now. And I would appeal to him to look at it again. And we will be seeking a meeting with him in the very near future to discuss all these aspects of the lack of housing and an MICA issue here in Donegal.
Councillor Jeremy McMonagall, thank you very much indeed for speaking to us this morning.
Thank you, Donal.
It's our pleasure, and we will be keeping, obviously, an eye on this one with interest. 086 60 25000, if you want to text us or WhatsApp us your comments. 07491 25000, if you want to give us a call. Now, let's move on to a completely different issue and move from housing within Donegal to the universe and how the universe is structured and how the universe developed, and a lot of very intelligent and erudite people working on that. None more so than Shane O'Sullivan. He's an assistant professor of astronomy at DCU, and he's involved in a project to understand how magnetism first arose. Delighted to say that Shane joins us on Zoom. Shane, good morning. How are you?
Morning, Dawn. I'm well, thank you.
Excellent. Shane, it's an interesting one, because obviously magnetism is a hugely vital part of the structure of this planet. Indeed, the North and South Poles are magnetic fields in themselves, and if it weren't for those magnetic fields, the Earth would be, you know, a very different prospect. The universe would be very different if it wasn't for magnetism, and we just sort of take it, it's there and it exists. But this is something you believe developed more so than just always was.
Yeah, so we're trying to understand by actually measuring it in various different environments in outer space. And what was surprising with our recent measurements with this very powerful radio telescope called DOFAR is that we were able to measure these magnetic fields very far away from stars or galaxies, just in these very low-density environments in the universe where there's very few particles, and we're not really sure exactly how the magnetic fields got there.
And from that point of view, it is part of a global network. Now, you're working very much on the LOFAR radio telescope at Birr Castle in County Offaly, but that's not a standalone facility. That's linked into a whole network globally.
Yeah, so it's a pan-European telescope. So there's about 56 stations spread throughout Europe. So they go from, you know, Ireland to like Latvia, and there's a lot of them in the Netherlands and various countries. And there's about 100,000 antennas. And we can combine those all together by, you know, connecting the signals through very fast, you know, internet cables to get an image that's basically like you had a telescope the size of Europe.
Now, you're standing, the background you have on the Zoom connection for those who are watching either on Facebook or on YouTube, that is effectively an image of the galaxy showing connecting magnetic fields and how they operate. What's the significance of the lines and the fields, and what bearing have they had on the way that the galaxy formed?
Yeah, so these field lines that are shown in this image, these are invisible, so they're just an artist's representation. So we measure their effect on the light. But what we know from magnetism is that it can push gas around, and so it can affect the clumping of matter in the very early universe. And so this affects how the first stars were formed and how the first galaxies formed. So it's a really key part of, you know, how we develop a picture or our understanding of how the universe developed. We have to put in magnetic fields as well.
We talk about the Big Bang and we talk about things like primordial soup, and then the it all clashed together and there was a Big Bang, and then planets were formed and the universe was formed, and then life evolved over the course of millions of years. But we don't maybe stop to think that it's not just a physical thing. It's also to do with magnetism. It's also to do with those forces that have shaped the way the Earth developed. And I think it's fair to say, from a layperson's point of view, it would be a fair thing to say that were it not for the development of magnetism and were it not for those magnetic fields, the Earth, the solar system, the galaxy indeed, as we understand them, would not exist.
Yes, or it would be very different to what we have now, and maybe we wouldn't exist, because, of course, the Earth's magnetic field protects us from very harmful radiation and particles from the sun that would damage our DNA. So it would mean that life on Earth just wouldn't be feasible if you didn't have these strong magnetic fields throughout the universe.
Obviously, this pan-European cooperation is really important, and you'll be communicating regularly with your colleagues in the Netherlands, in Latvia, and all points in between. How close are we to now? We're never going to get the ultimate answer. I know Dara O'Brien, the comedian, once made a very interesting observation. He said, science doesn't know everything. Of course it doesn't know everything. If science knew everything, it would stop. So you're never going to fully understand everything. But how close are you to a deep level of understanding of this? Or is there always going to be something to learn? Is there always going to be another imponderable question that you're going to be striving to answer?
I suspect that's true, that we will always be striving to answer the next challenging question, because usually when we discover something new, it maybe answers one question, but it asks maybe or begs about 10 other questions that we then need to try and follow up and answer. So this is the exciting thing about science, is that you're always pushing the boundaries and trying to discover something new. And when you do, then you end up with many more questions.
Are there practical applications for what you're learning in terms of magnetism, even in terms of things like climate change and the impact that climate is having on Earth? I mean, is there any way in which what you're discovering and what you're studying can feed into the debate on how we tackle climate change, how we protect the environment, how we protect our planet? I mean, can this give a perspective on that?
So not directly. So it can stimulate the curiosity of people for science and how the world works, but also the technologies we develop to measure these very sensitive magnetic fields. So these are these very low cost kind of sensor technologies. And this is kind of pushing the boundary of, you know, how we effectively use these sensors and how we develop them. And this helps in like using these sensors in other areas to monitor the Earth and how its climate is evolving. So it's kind of, you know, it's pushing the boundaries with the incredible amounts of data that we get from the telescope, and this helped kind of develop new technologies in kind of surprising ways.
And I suppose a large part of your job, and really the core of your job, is when you get these massive amounts of data, your particular skill is going to be sitting down and looking at reams and reams of data and being able to extrapolate from that data the important pieces of information that actually build up the actual real understanding of what's going on out there. And that's only something you're going to get through years and years of experience.
Yes, and large teams of people as well. So I don't know if your listeners are familiar or heard of petabytes. You've probably heard of terabytes, but a petabyte is about 1,000 times larger than a terabyte of data. And for this work, we had to process 8 petabytes of data. And, you know, we use high-performance computers, which is kind of the equivalent of using something like 20,000 laptops to actually analyze our data and produce the results. And so this is done with a large collaboration, you know, hundreds of people you know, scientists spread throughout Europe and the world that are really working very hard to analyze this data and then, you know, produce all the science results from that.
Over the course of the COVID pandemic, like everybody else, my wife and I staycationed and we spent a couple of days in the Midlands and just happened to visit Birk Castle while we were down there. And you know, predominantly went down actually because I knew the original telescope from the 19th century was there and I wanted to see that. Now, and it was only then as we walked around, I actually saw the Lofar telescope. And I must confess, even at that point, didn't realise it was playing such a vital role in this pan-European programme. It just looked like a nice, quiet little telescope that occasionally someone would go in and have a look at. It appears from what you're saying that it's playing a far more important role maybe than people even who know it well appreciate.
Yeah, so arguably you can say that it's the most powerful radio telescope in the world and it's the most underwhelming to look at. So it's just pieces of wire basically on the ground or close to the ground.
Yeah.
And all the expense and most of the expense in the technology is in the hardware that combines all the signals and then the software and computers to analyze the data and the fiber optic cables that are needed to connect all the different stations throughout Europe. So it's really a very, you know, intense technological and software effort. In addition to these, you know, to collect or use the information collected from these pieces of wire.
Sean O'Sullivan, Assistant Professor of Astronomy at DCU. Thank you very much indeed for speaking to us this morning and maybe giving us a little bit more understanding of these huge issues. I mean, where did we come from? What's the origins of the universe? I mean, what huge questions to be answering. And thanks indeed for sharing some time with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's been our pleasure. Now, I want to go to line one because we're going to have a very important conversation before the 11 o'clock headlines. Paul Carr from Cranford is an aid worker from Concern and he has been working in Turkey in the aftermath of that horrific earthquake. Paul, good morning.
Good morning, Donal. Thanks for having me.
It's our honour and our privilege, Paul. I know you're doing really important work. One of the things that I read this morning, and I have to be honest, it stunned me, is when I realised that the actual size of the earthquake zone itself, in comparative terms, would stretch from Letterkenny to Cork City.
Yeah, I think that's something that struck me as well whenever I got here and, you know, in the last 10 days or so, just kind of coming to comprehend the scale and the size of it. And then, you know, from east to west or from as a width, it's something like Dublin to Connemara. So it really is the length and breadth of our country. So the scale is massive. I mean, and then when you consider then, other than the geographic scale, like the loss of lives is, I think at the moment it's over 42,000. And, you know, you're looking at 17 million or so people directly impacted across Turkey and Syria. So the scale is quite overwhelming and pretty unprecedented, both in Turkey and globally.
In terms of the work you're doing, there is a further complication because obviously, as well as Turkey, it's taking in part of Syria as well, but it's a part of Syria that's contested. There is an ongoing war. There is instability at the best of times along the border, and that political instability certainly, I'm sure, hasn't helped your efforts in terms of working with Concern.
No, it certainly isn't helping. I mean, Northwest Syria is a particularly challenging case. Even before the earthquake, you know, roughly 90% of people in Northwest Syria are relying on humanitarian 10 years of civil war. And now we have on top of that, you know, a devastating earthquake. Infrastructure was already poor in that area, you know, in terms of basic services, education, healthcare. Infrastructure in terms of buildings would not be of the quality that you might have in Turkey. So yeah, the challenges are particularly so, you know, impacts may be similar. So the impact of earthquakes can be felt in the same way, but the impacts of them can be different depending on you know, the circumstances that the people find themselves in.
And from your own point of view, Paul, I mean, you know, you're on the scene. You at the moment are based in an office and you're sleeping on a couch in that office because the building you're in happens to be deemed at this point in time to be structurally safe. But the infrastructure around where you are, lots of collapsed buildings, lots of your colleagues sleeping in cars and you know, people just trying to do what they can literally to survive at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, we've been lucky in a sense here, concerned that we do have an office that, that you know, I can, I mean, it's a couch, but it's perfectly safe, it's perfectly warm, and, you know, I don't have any immediate threat to my person. But yeah, you know, our staff and people in the surrounding provinces and cities, they've lost their lives, they've lost family members' lives, they've lost their homes. You know, they don't have schools to go to, they don't have hospitals to go to. Staff, you know, they've been slowly starting to move out of the building, but in the immediate aftermath, they were sleeping in cars, tents, you know, in the office building here. Yeah, everyone's been touched by the earthquake in one way or another, but nonetheless, their ability to respond immediately and at a good scale has been, you know, unbelievable and really, really inspiring.
I heard one of the aid agencies last weekend, Paul, say that when it comes to supporting the work that you're doing on the ground, the most important thing at this point of view is cash, because a lot of people, you know, are trying to organise collections of clothing and other collections to help as they can, and it's a natural human instinct to try and help. But the word coming from the agencies, and I'm sure you'd probably echo this, is look, if you want to give us help, please give us cash, because we can use that immediately to bring what relief we can.
I mean, I suppose the first thing I'll say, you know, I've worked with Concern for a number of years. I've also worked in strong connection with fundraising, and the people of Donegal and the people of Ireland have always shown their incredible generosity. And, you know, already we've seen that in the last 10 or 11 days. The road to recovery is very long, and you know, we're looking at immediate assistance now, and also in devising how we can support, you know, tens of millions of people in the longer term. But you're absolutely right. You know, there are a lot of the devastation is huge. The needs are huge. The supplies that we need to be able to deliver are very demanding. And the best way we can get those supplies are, first of all, in country. And then, you know, just last night we were flying in planes from Dubai. We brought in the first of three consignments of essential needs from Dubai. And, you know, we need the flexibility to be able to get supplies as quickly as we can to the people that need it. And the best way to do that is, you know, go to our website, www.concerngod.net. and donate cash. It gives us the flexibility to do what we do as fast as we can.
And people can also call 0818 410 510 as well, if they so choose.
Exactly, yeah.
Paul, thanks for giving us this insight. I mean, and God bless you, and God bless the work, as my mother would have said. You know, it's hugely important what you're doing, and, you know, it's good to know there are people like yourselves on the ground, and I know a lot of people will obviously want to help. So listen, Paul, hang in there, all the best with the work you're doing, and thank you for it,